This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, getting a new perspective on World War II today from a 96-year-old who had a unique role in the Army Air Corps. Go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page to see photos of Fred Stevenson then and now, and even a look at a couple of his clever creations. Let's pick up where we left off, sir.
What you said was that after a while, you learned not to make friends with anyone. But the way you learned that lesson was by losing guys that you knew.
The flying was in its infancy of long flights. The earphones they used were ones that just went over your head, and then the helmets went down over the earphones. The pressure of them helmets pushing on those earphones over a long flight were driving these flyers crazy from the pain. And so we came up with an idea of cutting holes in the helmets so that the biggest part of the earphone was on the outside. And then later on, the regular radio operators had a sponge deal that went on their earphones. We found out we could sew these sponge ones on the inside of their helmets, and that made it so they had no problem. But then the radio operators were mad at us because every time they laid down their earphones, they would lose the sponge rubbers because they were bringing them over to us to put in the helmets. One thing that was really amusing is a professional wrestler was one of the crew members or one of the gunners, and he had cauliflower ears. He came in to have something done because he couldn't stand it. He had to take his helmet off. So I fixed him up with a special deal with a sponge rubber and stuff like that. And he went on his first flight. When he came back, he was so happy that he grabbed me in a bear hug and just about killed me. He was so happy to have that pressure off of his ears.
Well, and I can see that's still an emotional memory for you, just thinking about it now. And when you say we came up with the idea, so you're saying that you guys in the sewing shop had this idea that a change that you made affected pretty much everyone else who flew in that bomb group for the rest of the war?
I'm not going to take credit for that because I don't exactly remember how we ever got the idea. It might have been from somebody else seeing it and telling us about it or not.
But it was not, when you say we, you're not talking about the Army Air Corps. You're talking about you guys at that base.
The guys in my sewing shop. Although I did, on my own, make some masks to fit over the gunners in the waist gun position because they were exposed to the air at 30,000 feet at way below zero, and it'd freeze up their oxygen masks. By that time, they had come up with the electric-heated suits, so I experimented taking a Navy mask and put electric heated wires in it and made it so that the fellas in the waist guns could wear them. I didn't make too many of them before I got an order from the 8th Air Force Headquarters, which was in High Wycombe outside of London, to report and bring one of the masks with me. And so I went down there, and they looked it all over and everything and congratulated on me for trying to help out. But they said we have our new oxygen masks have heaters built in them, and so they weren't really necessary anymore. But they kept the one that I brought with me and said they put it in some museum. I guess, I imagine, really relic by now.
So bright minds think alike, I guess. You just beat them to the punch with the one that that you jerry-rigged. Where do those ideas come from? I mean, did they just pop into your head that you've got a way to solve a problem no one else has solved?
They had what they call an Air Corps supply, is what they supplied the stuff to the flyers and stuff. And I knew the operator, or the head guy, and I was in his building, and I saw a pile of masks. They were white on one side and dark blue on the other. And I said, "What are they?" And he says, "Oh, it's a missed shipment. It must have went there were Navy for the gunners on the battleships to wear." And he says, "I have no use for them. And so I got the idea maybe I could adapt some of those into masks. They went all over their face and had a skirt that went down over their chest. I says, can I have one? He says, you can take the whole bunch. He says, I have no use for them. So I took some of them and I experimented in my spare time. I stayed in my shop. I bunked in there and stuff to save guys having to come from the barracks to keep it open all the time. And so I had all this spare time, and so I took time out to experiment with these masks.
So you were basically on call any time, because if someone needs a chute or a mask or anything like that, they need it now.
We had to be open 24 hours a day. That way, living in my shop, I just took care of it. We had to fit the oxygen masks and fit their clothes, and all guys aren't built the same. And
so you're a tailor, too.
That's right. And so with the change, with the loss of all this personnel casualties, we were kept busy all the time because there was always a bunch coming in.
Did that ever weigh on you when you realized how many guys are out there either getting killed or injured or taken prisoner?
Yes, it did. It looked like high school letting out when these guys came in, just young kids. And they had no idea what they were in for until after I had a flight or something. It was heartbreaking.
I can tell that you have great respect for the men who served in the Army Air Corps in World War II and carried out those missions that you were assisting them with this different equipment and clothing and everything. I know it's hard to describe a group of thousands, but how do you remember those guys as a whole, the people that served in the Air Corps at your base during World War II?
I had a lot of respect for them. The young ones didn't know what they were getting into, and then seeing them after their first couple of flights, it was a real experience. And then they'd have to have three, four flights before they actually got to know what was the whole deal was about. And some of them were real brave about it. And some of them were pretty worried about every flight. And there were some, I think, even actually enjoyed it. I don't know.
You're talking about the invasion of Normandy in June of 44. And most people think about the guys hitting the beach. They forget about all the paratroopers who jumped behind enemy lines and all the bombers that were in the sky. What was your perspective on that? And how did you see that play out at your base?
Our base was real busy during the invasion. They were one flight after another going out all day long. And then the weather wasn't too good for us. They had a lot of low clouds and stuff, and some of the planes that went up couldn't find their own base, and they were landing at ours, and it was a real mix-up. I couldn't do anything but feel sorry for the guys involved in that invasion, because everything was against them.
One of the reasons I've come across the base where you were before is I knew a man whose American plane was shot down between one base and another because the Germans had planes that would come over the English coast at night and shoot them down. Did you know that was happening? Did you know that the German fighters were in the air?
Yeah. In that our area, they had searchlights and night fighters. You could go out practically any time the weather was halfway good, and you would see these searchlights, and they'd be four or five searchlights converge in one spot, and you'd watch in that spot, and you'd see a burst of flame, and it was the German planes that got into that spotlight, and those guys on those spotlights were good enough that once he got in that cross, he didn't get out of it, and the fighter planes would just come and shoot where that lights crossed. And they'd get the invader.
Who needs the movies when you can go outside and watch that show, huh?
That's right. But it got give you an idea of what was going on. It wasn't all fun and games.
Did you ever have any famous folks or big shots visit your base?
Oh, yes. We had some of the top guys. And then Glenn Miller and his orchestra played at our base when I think it was our 100th mission. We closed down the base and had a party, and they had Glenn Miller and his band playing at the base. That was a strange thing that Glenn Miller was lost flying over the North Sea, and there was a whole bunch of different rumors of what happened. And I never did really hear what actually was the cause of the plane going down.
And that must have been not too long after he played that concert for you. Did that make you kind of feel good? Because, I mean, you guys all knew who Glenn Miller was back in the States. Did it make you wish your wife was there to dance a string of pearls with her or what?
It was a wild party. I don't know whether I'd wished anybody really close to me to be at it. But they sent special trains from London with women to entertain us. I never did go into the party myself, but they really had some times there, getting rid of the women after they were supposed to go home.
Well, speaking of going home, you got to go home, see your wife again, and meet your son for the first time. Tell me about that. How did that happen, and what did that feel like?
Well, he had been with his mother, and she lived with her folks, and my son had been with women all the time, and here come this guy grabbing him and hugging him, and he didn't want nothing to do with me. In fact, it was a real kind of a heartache to try to even get close to him.
I do want to say thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us about it. What do you think is important for the rest of us? I mean, you have kids and grandkids and great-grandkids, even a great-great-grandchild. All these folks who weren't alive in World War II, what do we need to know about all of those of you who were and who fought that war and won that war?
Well, I don't want to get started in on that, but what I think is the World War II that I was in was actually the last war that we actually won. And all the wars have been negotiated and stuff like that, and we always seem to come off the short end. I'm thinking that we ought to turn around and start winning wars instead of negotiating the ends of them.
What are you most proud of with regard to your own service in the war?
I'm real proud of Harry Truman, that he had guts enough to use the atomic bomb in Japan. It saved thousands and thousands of our men's lives the way he did it. And I don't think there's a guy in Washington that has the guts enough to do what he did.
With regard to your specific involvement, all those parachutes you packed, the masks that you fixed for people, the adjustments you made to headsets to make it so they could actually fly and not feel like their head was in a vice grip. Do you take some satisfaction in that? Do you feel like you made a contribution?
I feel I did my part, but I don't think I'm any hero. These people that are saying, oh, you're a hero or something like that. I was just doing a job, and I don't look at it as anything different than that.
Who are the heroes in your mind?
The fellows are actually doing the flying, and they're subject to going up in those airplanes and taking the brunt of the war.
Now, I saw in this great article you have from the 95th Bomb Group newsletter, you peeking out the window of the cockpit of a bomber. Was that just a photo op, or did you get that bird up in the sky?
No, I never flew when I was over in England. But, of course, I wanted to get a picture in one of the airplanes. In fact, that particular airplane was a famous airplane. It was one that was flown from the States over to England. It did a real good job of bombing and everything. I think that was the same airplane. They became war-weary. They stripped the armament out of it and used it for transferring parts from the depot to our air bases. And I think that was the plane that they were taking the fellas back to rest in Scotland that crashed, that I wasn't was supposed to be aboard.
Wait a second. There's a story here. You were supposed to be aboard a plane that went down and killed all the guys on board?
Right. I got to know a first lieutenant that was one of the pilots. We became good friends. In fact, his last name was Witt. He was from Texas. We got to the point where we kidded each other and stuff, and I called him Nit because his last name was Witt, and we got big kick out of him. Well, he was the pilot of a plane that was taking these war-weary flyers to a rest deal in Scotland. Him knowing that I had relatives in Scotland, he said, well, why don't you come along with me, and we'll take him up there and be our 3 days, and we'll come back. Well, I said, well, how can you stay with me for 3 days when you're supposed to come back? And he says, well, they have a crew chief on this plane, and he says, if I tell that crew chief there's something wrong with the plane and it takes him 3 days to fix it, we'll be there. So anyway, he says, we're going to take off tomorrow morning real early, but if you can get a pass and go, I'll make you my co-pilot. But early in the morning, about 3 o'clock in the morning, I got a phone call in my shop, and it was him on the phone, and he says, you know, they run a whole bunch more guys in the bunch that I'm taking up there this flight, and he says, I don't have room for you. So I said, well, that's all right. We'll do it some other time. And he says, I'll make a point of that. Well, they took off at daybreak, and about an hour or so later, I got a phone call saying the plane had crashed and every one of them was cremated.
I can't imagine what that felt like. Do you remember? How do you react to news like that?
I tell you, I wasn't a Christian before that, although my wife, my family were. But when I thought of there's somebody up there watching over over me, I better get to it. And I did.
Right then?
That's right. So I've been a Christian ever since.
You're 96 years old now, but people can hear how with it you are, how sharp your memory is. What's your secret? What keeps you going?
I really don't know. I just think I'm too ornery for the devil to take me and too ornery for the Lord to take me too. So I'm just waiting for them to make up their mind.
Well, we're all happy that hasn't happened yet. Fred Stevenson of Porterville, California. Check out the photos on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And join us again next time when we're reminded once more through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.